This is an ABC podcast.
Last week, the James Webb Space Telescope gave us the most awesome portal onto the heavens above. Those images are completely mind-blowing. But sometimes space has another way of telling us what's out there.
We probably get hit by objects every couple of 100,000 years that are big enough to trash the global food supply for a couple of years.
It's such a bizarre thought, isn't it, that a meteor might one day cause complete mayhem here on Earth. And I say that with a smile, but I've got to say, in the dark of the night, that gives me the complete heebie-jeebies. Hi, it's Natasha Mitchell here on Science Friction. Meteors aren't always scary, though. They are actually full of delicious secrets about the cosmos, about the origins of all of us and all of life. So I've got a ripping yarn for you today on Science Friction. We're heading back to 2015 and joining reporter Robbie McEwen as he chases a crew of meteor chasers on this wonderfully crazy quest across the Australian outback. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that today's program contains the voice of a deceased person.
Just went out on our little veranda for a smoke and a relax after work, and there's no lights out here, so all you can see is like a silhouette of a sand dune. And then all of a sudden saw this sort of flash and ran out and went, whoa, what was that? You know, this bright, bright streak across the sky. It was so close, but I thought we were like about to have nuclear war.
What Liz, a cook at the remote outback pub of William Creek, saw that night was something far more alien. A rock from space, older than the Earth, tearing through the sky in a ball of flame. And something else was out there, watching, waiting for a rock like this to arrive. A few hundred metres away, past a graveyard of rusting cars, there was a camera, quietly taking photos of the night sky and sending the pictures to its master, Professor Phil Bland.
The fireball on the images was actually this beautiful, long, green flash.
Phil heads up the brand new Desert Fireball Network, based at Perth's Curtin University. And the green flash on that photo, that would trigger a search that would send Phil across the continent and into the most desolate reaches of the outback. PhD student and Desert Fireball team member Ali Sampson was one of the first to see it.
A few of us were trying to learn how to use the supercomputer, and we got an email saying, oh, we've got quite a bright fireball on one of the images. So in the middle of our course, while trying to pay attention and run code that they were teaching us, we were also trying to run stuff in the background to get the analysis of this fireball.
And the prize at the heart of that fireball? A meteorite. So while Ellie's team was supposed to be doing coursework, what they were really doing was trying to calculate if and where this meteorite had landed. Because if they succeeded, then Phil could go off and try and find it.
We managed by the end of the day to actually have a predicted mass for the object, even though half the team were supposedly doing other things.
And it wasn't long until they had a landing spot, an X on their meteorite treasure map, where a burnt black rock sat and waited.
So at that point, we knew absolutely we were going to go out. This is a rock on the ground, and we've got to get it. The benefit of getting one of these things is so great scientifically. To be honest, I would have gone there on my own if I had to and walked.
And amazingly, that's not an exaggeration. Phil had been working towards this moment for almost 20 years. He'd already moved from London to Australia to dedicate himself to building this network. I'll explain exactly what that is in a moment, but after all this time, they'd really just switched it on.
It was an idea that I had really a very long time ago, maybe 16, 17 years ago, almost timescale of a space mission type thing. You know, you get the idea and it just takes a long, long time to get the money and then a long, long time to build it. And I love the tiny part I play in the human scientific project, because I do feel like it's the most beautiful thing that humans can do.
And this network that Phil's built, it really is beautiful in its elegance and simplicity. Basically, his team took a bunch of cameras and installed them across the outback looking up. They're automated and set to capture that brief moment when a fireball, which is just a huge meteor really, burns a line through the atmosphere. Now when they see one, they can use the photos to triangulate that line's exact position in the sky and then plot a trajectory forward to find a landing spot. But the kicker is, not only can they plot a trajectory forward to find a landing spot, they can also follow it back out into space to figure out where in the whole of the solar system this thing has come from. And that's what makes this project so valuable. Of the 50,000 or so meteorites we've found, we only know where a few dozen actually come from. And when you know that, you know you've got a sample of the asteroid belt or Mars or a distant comet. Now, projects like this have happened before, but they haven't really found many meteorites. Phil's blinding innovation was to put one of these networks in the Australian desert where you can actually find the rocks. So if the network works as Phil hopes, it'll generate a tidal wave of new data that could revolutionise our understanding of the solar system.
We don't know why the Earth has the composition that it does, which at the end of the day, if there's one major question in planetary science, then surely it's how did the Earth form? How easy is it to get the conditions for life? And those are all the kind of giant questions that I think drive most people in my subject. We naturally try and find ways of explaining the universe around us with stories, but those stories are mostly not scientific.
It's strange, because Phil, an atheist and a scientist, is really looking for the answers to life's central mysteries. What is our world, and how did we get here? The questions that historically have always been in the realm of religion, and we've all looked for the answers. The only thing that changes is where we look. And today, Phil and other scientists, they look to meteorites. That's because most meteorites are older than the Earth. They formed during the birth of the solar system, and they're a record of that time. Finding one's like finding a box full of keepsakes and memories from childhood, a record of who you used to be. Written into the composition of the rock are clues to what we once were, and answers to how our planet turned from drifting rubble into a living world. But before the meteorite's secrets can be read, we've still got to find it.
So then we dived into the data and we worked out that it's actually bang in the middle of Lake Eyre, which is, well, good and bad. Good in terms of little black rock on salt flat. Bad in terms of salt flats, and they're often full of water.
Phil and two colleagues, Robert Howie and Dr. John Paxman, set off to the outback of South Australia, hoping to find their meteorite on a dry salt pan, but worried they might find the salt pan full of water. To make things more difficult, a storm was forecast. A rainstorm that would wash away any sign of the meteorite if it reached the area before them. The search had just become a race against the weather. So after days of travelling, the researchers in two white four-wheel drives sped towards the dusty desert town that was to be their base.
Coming into Murray, a little town comes up ahead of you. I guess it actually feels a little bit like in the sort of Old West where kind of riding a town on your horse and you get off the horse and you go into the bar. And it's a little bit like that for a moment.
Waiting for them at the bar was their local guide. An old Aboriginal cowboy and rail worker wearing jeans and plaid.
My name's Dean Stewart. I'm an Arawana person from around the Maori region. I've seen a lot of country on horseback, sort of riding around slowly, mustering cattle and all that. You take notice, and I think that's why you fall in love, where you get more time to study the land.
Dean and his mate Dave Strangways were there to help Phil navigate the rough land and sacred sites of the area. Racing the storm, they set off cross-country to reach the salt pan.
How do you think that the Arawana men saw you?
Hopefully they left with the impression that I was a bit more experienced than they thought at the beginning. I've been going out in the bush for...
What did they... Clearly they thought something at the beginning. What did they think at the beginning?
Well, look, I'm English. You fit the stereotype of absent-minded professor, and I am an absent-minded professor for the best of time.
There were three cars. I was in front. But when we went off-road, they were getting bogged and everything, so I think it would have been a struggle for Phil and the boys to find it. And with their experience in their driving. don't tell them that, though.
You know when you're a kid and you go to the ocean for the first time and you're looking and you just get a hint of kind of this open space, maybe over the next line of hills. But when you see it, it's stunning.
Keritanda, Lake Eyre, a vast, dry emptiness. And somewhere out there was their rock.
I've seen the lake dry and just the white salt as far as the eye can see. But I've also seen it like an ocean splashing up against the old railway line, and they put boulders alongside the track to stop it from washing the old railway track away.
Found in the South Australian desert, they call it the Inland Sea, but it's more like an enormous basin of salt where water flows in only to be burnt away by the intense heat. It's tens of metres below sea level, and one European explorer wrote of its death-like stillness and vast expanse of unbroken sterility. Here's Trevor Wright, publican and local pilot.
To go out there is a totally surreal experience. It's the closest visually that you'll get to the Antarctic without actually being there.
Trevor's pub is in the nearby town of William Creek. And Liz, the cook who saw the fireball, she works for him.
I think it was a general discussion across the bar, you know, that they saw this light going through and they thought, wow, what's going on here?
And it turns out Trevor's seen some things too.
Well, I have sat behind my younger day out here in William Creek and watched something go vertical very fast, and it went horizontal, then it went vertical again. And I hadn't been drinking, so I'm pretty sure that there was something behind it, whether it was military or not. It's hard to say, but because we're only 8 kilometres from the Woomera prohibited area, and Woomera's back in the 60s and the 50s and that, sent off a lot of rockets. They had just landed anywhere, and there's still some out here in the clay pans vertically up and down like they've got on the cartoons, like the Roadrunner and the Coyote and that. They're just sitting out there.
The relative emptiness of the desert doesn't just attract meteorite hunters. A huge restricted area is cordoned off for military research concerned more with how to end things than finding beginnings. Luckily, Phil's meteorite just missed the Woomera prohibited area, but they still had to get kilometres out onto muddy salt flats and beat the rain. Phil's colleague Robert Howey was part of the search team.
Once we got to the lake, this mud is like this dense, salty clay, and you're driving along in this quad bike and it's flicking up in the air, it's getting all over your face, you're eating it. I wasn't really prepared for that, but we actually managed to make it to the fall site.
I think the nearest thing is kind of, it's like fishing, you know, you sort of cast your eyes out and then scan the area, and then you walk in a little bit further and you cast your eyes out and you scan. And we kind of expected it to be fairly obvious and we couldn't see it. And I am covered in mud. I mean, I have never been this muddy before in my life. I've not found it. And this is a huge chance for us to kind of show really what the project can do. It's really the kind of first test. And I think probably out of everyone, I'm the one who's having more doubts.
And yeah, time was running out.
So all this time, the weather forecast is changing.
That's right. Really dire warnings about just how bad the rain was going to be.
In fact, heavy rain was already falling to the north, filling rivers that flowed towards them, threatening to wash away any sign of the meteorite in the mud. And Phil had just spent 15 years of his life convincing people to help make this network. You can imagine the dread of going home empty-handed. But it's not just about the project or our origins. It's also about, at the risk of sounding crazy, the survival of the human race.
We probably get hit by objects every couple of 100,000 years that are big enough to trash the global food supply for a couple of years.
If it works, Phil's Desert Fireball Network has the ability to help prevent that. If an asteroid similar to the one that killed the dinosaurs hit today, it'd throw a cloud of liquid rock back into the stratosphere, which would cool into glass and envelop the Earth. Then the glass would fall, raining fire on re-entry and pushing temperatures up hundreds of degrees. Any survivors would emerge to find a burnt Earth, nothing left but ash and a fresh new crater. With the Desert Fireball Network, Phil hopes to create a kind of early warning system by identifying what are known as asteroid streams. These are theorized streams of debris. enormous rocks travelling through space in a line, one behind the other, like wagons on a train. With the network's ability to tell where asteroids and meteorites come from, Phil could identify asteroid streams our orbit passes through. Then we can know when we're due to pass through it next, and at least prepare for a possible impact. Back at Caritanda Lake Air, the storm grew closer, and another day of searching passed with no results. Dean Stewart.
We still couldn't find it on the Wednesday. So coming back, I said to Phil, the only way we can find this now, we, you know, have a talk to Trevor.
Traffic in the William Creek area, echo in the Yankees, departing William Creek, we're tracking to the east, 500 feet.
When they rang up and said, can you organise a search aircraft to see if we can go and find it, I thought, you've got to be dreaming.
And Trevor knows what he's talking about. He's been on plenty of tough searches in the area for much bigger things.
We spent a day looking for an aircraft. We got a radio call from the aeroplane on the ground there saying that the engine had failed and his survival beacon wasn't working. And we said to him, can you burn the tyre on your aeroplane? So what gave it away was the black smoke. And here we are looking for this meteorite the size of a football.
The next day was the last chance. The storm front swept towards them with thick clouds blanketing the horizon. And if it rained much, the dirt roads and the salt pan would become impassable, and any sign of the meteorite would be washed away. Professor Phil and colleague Robert headed back to the dry lake on their own, while fellow researcher John travelled with Arabana guide Dean Stewart to try to meet the plane at the airfield.
But I stopped three times just to check this rain coming in, because I was driving towards it. I thought, shall I go further?
There's showers now, you know. It's raining on the windscreen. I'm just willing it to evaporate, you know. It's like, please don't rain much. Anything serious, and that lake is just going to turn into the world's biggest mud bath. We'd be stuffed.
And when it rains in the desert, it really rains.
If it poured down anymore, I was going to turn around and go back to Mare. But I thought, no, I'll keep going.
And then it's getting heavier. So I say to Robert, look, mate, the plane hasn't turned up yet. We've got to pull it. So we just hang in there. And it really is, you know, perfectly in the middle of nowhere. You know, it's so white, so flat. You're just two guys on two little quad bikes and you can't see anything else. It's almost like the kind of definition of limbo.
Usually Phil's the sort of unflinching optimist, but in this case, I can't say to him, you know, they'll probably be here soon. So in this case, well, it paid off.
Just in time, Trevor flew into limbo.
You've got to visualise this incredibly white, flat surface area. And here's these two small ants on the bottom of it, and they're trying to do a grid search up and down a couple of metres apart.
And the guys were flying over and they were flying around and they were circling for about an hour. Kind of thinking, well, look, they must have seen it by now. There's no way that they wouldn't have seen it by now. And so, again, I'm thinking that it's basically been washed away. And then John lets out a shout and he says, oh, I think I've seen it.
I ended up spotting what looked like a micro anthill from that height. It was something that once you did pinpoint it, you had to stay with it. You just couldn't drift off in any direction because it would be so hard to find again.
And then they loop back and they can't find it again. They lose it again.
We were going to have to go and land and refuel as well, and then you would have had light issues. So you felt that emotion over the radio, like going to the MCG for a cricket match and the Poms had hit the ball and the Aussies had just about caught it, but it had slipped through their hands at the last minute.
By this point, rain was slowly filling the lake from the north.
And they're searching again. It's probably 15 minutes, 20 minutes again, and they pick it up again. I'm kind of running out. I mean, actually trying to run on the mud, you know, which is kind of interesting.
It was a case of saying, look, can you keep going 100 metres in the direction you're going now and then slowly start a left-hand arc, then turn to the left again, turn in 3 metres and go down to the south.
And we spotted.
Phil was running over towards the feature and really all that was left was like a small salt ring, like a coffee stain on the salt lake.
At that point, I thought, this has to be it. But I still can't actually believe it.
Robert pulled out his camera and recorded Phil kneeling in the mud, his arm plunged deep into a hole.
We'll do one more pass over here.
Roger.
God, that's going a long way. If it is, I'll meet you right.
What, do you want a break?
No, I gotta do it.
Oh.
This has been 15 years, mate.
I know.
Holy fuck. It's a meter out here. Absolutely fucking amazing!
Ground, Echo Indy Yankee, the guys are ecstatic, they're dancing up and down. We reckon they'll be back at the pub in 4 to 5 hours.
It was the best moment that I've ever had in the field.
Back in the city, PhD student Ellie Sampson got the news.
Phil called us all individually, no matter where we were in the world, and it was amazing, so there was a lot of champagne drunk that night.
They got a coin-operated telephone in the hotel, so I just got this massive stack of dollar coins, and I'm ringing up everyone. All of this effort over so many years, and it works, you know? You've turned the key in the ignition and the engine started, and okay, great. There's no real obstacle now to us getting lots and lots of meteorites.
What strikes me is that you're really looking for the creation.
Basically, it gives us I'm obviously trying to avoid the word creation, you know, from a religious background. I grew up in quite a religious family and lost that at a fairly early age. But it's really trying to put that together, trying to put part of that detail together. My family is still very religious. I'd really like to be able to talk with them about my job. We talk about a lot of other things, but not that.
Dean Stewart.
Yeah, I'm glad to know what the site is trying to do, like with the meteorite, and to learn a bit more about the universe.
What do you think about how the Earth formed and how the solar system came to be?
For me, I think it's somebody put it there. I don't think we come from the Big Bang. You know, like, how are we so far away from the sun? If we're too close, we'll melt. If we're too far away, we'll freeze. How do we get rain? Why do we get rain? The air we breathe. How can that be? How can that happen?
I always loved going mountaineering. That's one of the reasons I got into geology. It's not just about this incredible view and the achievement of getting there. You know that the roots of that mountain go down like 120 kilometers. That's more wonderful than any kind of human imagination about what the universe looks like. Actually knowing what it is adds to the majesty of it. Then it turns out that the Earth isn't special, that it's another planet amongst billions in our galaxy. People often kind of equate that immensity, you know, that it diminishes humans, that it diminishes our place in the universe. I never feel like that. You flip it all around and we are the only species to be able to sit on top of that mountain and think about how deep the roots of it go. And the Earth is the only planet that we know of where there's the biosphere. And we're the only species maybe in the universe that's thought up science and the ability to actually understand the universe around them. So in a way, we are tiny, but in another way, we're magnificent.
Science has shown us so much, but it's also shown us its limits. We catch these meteorites that come to us by chance, the Desert Fireball team hunting them to extract every ounce of data. But one thing the project illustrates is that most of the universe remains so out of reach and essentially unknowable, which is where faith comes in. Even in ourselves, there's unknowable spaces that many people experience as an emptiness. So whether it's Phil's faith in the scientific method or Dean's in a creator God, there's wonder in both that fills that emptiness and fuels our ongoing search for answers. Phil invited Dean and the Arabana people to name the meteorite, and it's been christened Murali, after Dean's grandfather who showed him hidden springs on the lake when he was a boy. The 4.5 billion year old Murali is now being studied in the lab, where it's sharing the secrets of our common past.
And the team has published some of the secrets revealed by Murali since that story was first brought to you by ABC RN's Earshot podcast 7 years ago now. And the Desert Fireball Network continues today under Phil Bland's leadership. You can help them out by reporting fireballs that you see via a phone app, the Fireballs in the Sky app. More info about all of that on the Science Friction website. Thanks to journalist Robbie McEwen and sound engineer Richard Gervin. I'm Natasha Mitchell. You can find me over on Twitter at Natasha Mitchell. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.